If you could tell us, Keith, a bit about yourself and, you know, why, and a bit about how you came to know so much about Haiti would be really great.
Super. Yeah, I was. I'm now the vice president. I guess backing up at the U.S. Institute of Peace. I've done this since 2019, vice president for Latin America and the Caribbean. But I started my career. I was ROTC at Brigham Young University and served a mission for the LDS Church in Colombia. Got seized with doing things overseas. Spent 4 years in the army. In special forces, was involved in the liberation of Grenada, and then work in Central America on what I now call nation building tasks. At the time, it was just trying to help stabilize El Salvador and different countries, and then went into the State Department after graduate school. Did 29 years in the State Department with a lot of small assignments outside state with the coalition in Iraq, seconded to the UN in Somalia, field service in Darfur. So a lot of kind of nation building type things. And two of the years in the State Department was in Haiti. So we were there from 95 to 97. And I kind of kept up with it in different assignments after that. I took a year off to write a book in 2016 to 17, wrote a book, Why Nation Building Matters, and Haiti was one of the chapters there, so revisited it then. And then we got into it from USIP in a growing program. We started mostly focused on Colombia and then added Venezuela and Northern Central America. And then 3 years ago, with things breaking in Haiti, we took that on as one of our priority countries. And for the last year especially, we've been involved in a range of things from the political to the security solutions for the current crisis.
Can you tell us what the U.S. Institute of Peace is and kind of give me the Wikipedia entry on it? Because I think it's something that a lot of the listeners maybe haven't heard of or have only maybe just heard of in fleeting passing.
Sure, which is unfortunate. I think we do have a weak brand, and I hope we can always work on that. So the U.S. Institute of Peace was founded in 1984. It actually goes all the way back to George Washington. He had this something he said in the 1790s, you know, we won the war, but we now need to secure the peace. And he had this idea of a peace academy all the way back then. So it didn't come to fruition for quite a while, but in the 70s, the number of congresspersons, congressmen and senators that had fought in World War II, and they said, you know, we spent an awful lot of energy and resources, vast amounts, on making war and doing that more effectively. And we've got NDU that trains our officers in how to be more effective war makers, but we don't have something that trains us on the art of peace. And not only as a way of avoiding war, but as it turns out, as a way of keeping nations that have been through war out of it, out of conflict in the future. So congressional resolution passed, or congressional law was passed in 1984 that established the charter, I guess, the Institute of Peace. Spent about 20-something years in office space up around DuPont Circle, basically a research institute, and then grew after 9/11 into more a combination of research, analysis, convening, which is really important to us, and then field programs. And so it's an institute that modest institute, congressionally funded, that has programs around the world, presence in 26 countries and programs in about 60, 200 staff in Washington, 200 abroad, 200, 300 abroad, doing, again, field programs and convenings on peace and peacemaking and trying to advance the understanding of it, the literature, the techniques and methods. And then also the USIP building. It's a beautiful building on 23rd and Constitution, just a stunning piece of architecture designed by Moshe Safdie, the great architect. And his intent was to infuse the principles of peace into architecture, as he does all over the world with his different things, from art galleries to libraries to the Rabin Center in Tel Aviv. And so it's got this magnificent architecture of light, transparency, bridges, and the wings of the dove on top. So really a unique space as well. So it's kind of also a monument as part of the National Mall to peace building and to the American commitment to peace.
What is convening?
Well, convening, I mean, some of it could be analytical convening, just getting people together to talk about anything from transitional to justice to the war in Ukraine to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Our convenings in Latin America are a lot of, we have run a Haiti working group. So a lot of it is just getting experts together. But on another level, it's sort of getting together, you know, antagonists or, you know, convening different groups that maybe wouldn't talk to each other otherwise, not antagonists necessarily, but groups that don't necessarily always line up, and getting them in the same space to walk through some issues and see where there's common ground. And that happens in our field offices as well as in Washington.
So when would you say your best knowledge of Haiti starts? There's a fantastic podcast for people who may know it and may not know it, called Revolutions by Mike Duncan. He did 40 episodes, I believe. Is it 40 or it's many on the Haitian Revolution? And terrific, terrific background. So go listen to that. But can you just tell us a little bit about Haiti's background? We want to build to where we are today and then try to figure out what can possibly be done to, you know, make things a little better tomorrow, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. The Revolutions podcast is great. There's another really good one on Duvalier. There's a Dictators podcast, because that's also a kind of a seminal part of it. Anyway, I got involved in 1995. We were serving in El Salvador, and I had a lot of experience with this sort of thing. So when we restored democracy there, Aristide had been out of power through a coup. We restored him, and there was a big peacekeeping mission, which I had experience with as well. So I was brought in 1995 to work in the embassy in a new kind of post-conflict stabilization section. It was a fascinating time for us as a family. We had four little kids under the age of six. One was like 2 months old and going into Haiti. So there's always all the Foreign Service family issues as well as that. And it was quite an adventure for all of us, I guess, in the end. But so 95 to 97 was where I really got the substantive experience. And it was enough, I think, to really understand the country and its history and its roots. You never know everything, but it was a pretty substantive block. And I would also say that it was a period of great progress. And, you know, you don't come out of there without understanding the challenges ahead. But I certainly came out seeing that there's a lot to work with in Haiti. And I think that's one of the main messages that I try to carry today, is people that are just ready to give up or say nothing's ever worked and this is a lost cause. Look at all the money we put into it, which is really not all that much. It's just, you know, you can't just ignore a country of 11 million people that's struggling as hard as Haiti is. And there are formulas that have worked, and there's ways to do this. But backing all the way up, I mean, it was a very heroic history of the revolutions, as Duncan gets into in great detail. But in 1804, Haiti becomes the second independent republic in the Americas. Very heroic, but brutal and violent revolution against the French and of these slaves that rose up and said enough of this, cast off their French overlords, and then spent the rest of that century in a really kind of a difficult place. And this is where a lot of the roots, I think, of today's problems were laid very early. It was a time of isolation. Haiti had no brothers, sisters, friends, parents. They were totally isolated. We cut them off because we were afraid of the example of a former, republic of former slaves, what that might do to our own internal issues. The rest of the Caribbean didn't know what to do with Haiti. They were French-speaking. The rest of the Caribbean was English-speaking or Spanish-speaking. And they had a long period of just internal discord. I mean, it was a period where the Haitian people themselves were divided up into sides. They had very polarizing leaders. And it became a period where violence very early on was kind of ingrained in politics. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, has been a part of their history that's really never quite been excised. And then, of course, there was the French demanding reparations for the, you know, the affront of actually, you know, burning plantations and all the things that went on during the revolutionary period. And a lot of those reparations they were forced to pay. So a really long period of isolation. 1915, the United States occupies Haiti following the assassination of a president, largely commercial reasons. Wilson was president. He had his own kind of racial issues. And anyway, long occupation, 20 years. I mean, it was a period, and this is where the picture gets really complicated, is it was a period of some progress in terms of the economy and infrastructure. Governance was stable because we were basically governing the country. So it wasn't a totally lost 20 years. You actually travel through Haiti today and you see a lot of the buildings that we had built all that time ago. So, but it was, you know, a pretty brutal occupation in the end, and not one where there was a great preparation made for what came after that. Then we go into the kind of the war period, and, you know, Haiti's just on the sidelines, progressing a little bit, but always up and down. By 57, the Duvaliers take over. So you got Papa Doc and then Baby Doc. So you have 57 to 86, so 30 years of rule by the Duvaliers. And again, I think that other podcast, Dictators, I think it's called, really good, because it gets into just how deep the crushing of the Duvaliers was of civil society, of any kind of political future. It was really, really bad. And we're a little bit complicit in that, because we went ahead, went along with the Duvaliers, as we did with a number of dictators in the hemisphere, just because of a fear that, you know, that absent him, they're going to go communist or whatever. So we're, you know, there's some American complicity there. So Baby Doc finally leaves. He was actually kind of starting to reform things, but he was also incredibly corrupt. People had it, so they finally cast him off. So there's this big flourishing, actually, of civil society, where farmers groups and business groups and workers and everybody's kind of coming together, the religious communities, they're coming together to get rid of the dictator. So very kind of a exciting period. But then it's back and forth between the people and the army and everybody else. We eventually get to an election in 91, and Aristide comes in. And he's got about 5 years that he governs. But in the middle of that is a coup. After only about a year, he gets knocked out by a coup. So the country's governed by these generals. We go through a whole process of trying to get him back in power. And eventually, all options fail, sanctions and isolation and all the rest. So we finally just put together an intervention. And it was kind of the classic 90s intervention. The United States comes in first with the coalition and then turns it over to the UN. So he comes back in. And then you've got just a long period of the ups and downs of international intervention and peace building. 94 to 2017, you've got some kind of a UN peacebuilding force there, with one exception, I think, from 2001 to 4. I think there might have been, not have been one. But other than that, there was almost always a UN peacekeeping mission of some sort, or a coalition that comes in briefly. So that, and there's a, you know, there's real ups and downs there. And again, I think people are a little quick to pull the trigger and say, well, none of this ever worked. Well, there were periods of progress. But the peacekeeping as it happened, was very inconsistent. It was very short term. And it's kind of funny thing to think about. If we're going in 6 months at a time, but we're going to do it 10 times, you know, it might have been better to kind of look at 6 years and say, hey, why don't we just plan for 6 or 10 years of this? It might have gone a little bit better, but it was very inconsistent. There was some real damage that the peacekeepers brought. There was an episode of cholera that killed 10,000 Haitians. Some sexual predation and some of the operations by the peacekeepers went awry in places like Cité Soleil. And then there was this tendency, Paul Farmer picked this up in his book, that everybody just wanted to go outside the institutions. This is a very common Haitian thing. And we kind of picked it up from the international community as well. But Aristide, for example, was very quick just to run around his own institutions. And the internationals did it as well. So the core institutions of governance and security never really cohered. In the end, they were kind of modestly priced. The ambition was low, but, you know, we had all these big ups and downs in peacekeeping. But then you had these other earthquakes. You had a political earthquake in 2004 when Aristide had been kind of stirring up different gangs, and they finally turned on him, and he's ready to get knocked out. There's two completely narratives on what happened, but one is that he, you know, it really was his time and we kind of rescued him. Another one is that he should have been allowed to continue on, even as difficult as it was. But he gets pulled out in 2004. Another small coalition comes in, turns it over to a longer term peacekeeping mission. That was the longest one, from 2004 to 2017. And then there was the literal earthquake in 2010, where, you know, the whole country just gets devastated. 200,000 people in a country that size, the whole capital wiped out, really. So really, you know, some real, you know, downs to all this as well. But there were, again, periods of growth and stability, and especially a development of civil society. So then to kind of close out, bring us up to date. 2017, you had the decision by the Trump administration to pull back on all peacekeeping missions worldwide. Some of them, you know, maybe they've been going on too long or whatever, but Haiti, that was really a rough decision, because what that meant is it pulled out the mentors and the trainers for the HNP. We reduced it down from a peacekeeping mission to basically a political observation mission. And with that, the gangs ascended, and they've never gone back. So they started to just take over more and more of Port-au-Prince. And then the political picture got very muddled, because you didn't have kind of the guardrails on the political picture. And so you had just a situation where the politics and the security just dropped precipitously. 2021, the President Moïse is assassinated. Prime Minister Henri had just been appointed days, I think, before. So he ends up as the acting de facto head of state. And then it's been 3 years of just deterioration of governance and security further to where we're now in the crisis we are, where gangs control most of Port-au-Prince.
I want to scoot back just a little bit. You called what happened in the 90s, it's like 20,000 troops in 1994, not an invasion, they were invited, right? You called it a classic 90s peacekeeping mission. What are the traits of a classic 90s peacekeeping mission?
Well, classic in the sense that the U.S. comes in first, kind of as in a hurry. So we put together a small coalition. We came in first. We did the heavy lifting and then turned over to the peacekeeping force. Classic, I would say, very ambitious, very multinational, very talented. And we have to point this out because it really is important. Special representatives. I mean, it was really some of the rock stars of peace building and of international peace and security. It was Brahimi, Lakhdar Brahimi, who, as you know, was a feature of peace building in a lot of different places. I worked with him twice in Afghanistan and in Haiti, and he was just an incredible guy. I mean, he knew he would, you know, he supported the Loya Jirga from the UN in Afghanistan, the first Loya Jirga in 2002, and I remember the briefing he gave to the staff. He just said, look, we're not here to run this thing. We're here to make sure that they run it, that it works, that they have the capacity to build on this great event. And it was a seminal event. I mean, whatever one thinks about how things turned out in Afghanistan, that first Loya Jirga was just a political event of the first order. Afghans came together for the first time in 30 years, saw the country together and everything else. That was him. He knew how to do that, how to have the security forces in the background, but where they needed to be to make sure things didn't go off the rails. And then he was followed by Enrique Terhorst, a Venezuelan jurist, another classic peace builder. I knew him first in El Salvador, worked closely with him there, and we both ended up in Haiti after that. Knew him very well, and just another one that knew how to maneuver through a very, very difficult political environment, security environment, and where to put the different components. So they had it, you know, it was a very strong mission, but knowing how to get the Haitians in the front of things. And then on the U.S. side, it was Ambassador Bill Swing, long service in different parts of Africa, really hard places. So anyway, I think I would point to the comprehensiveness, the size, and classic in the sense of really coming in with a heavy advisor presence for the HNP. And there's a whole story to that. My book covers a lot of this about, you know, what we did to try to just support this new force that was really going to be struggling, but, you know, to put the right components in the right places to where it could function. I mean, one of the examples, again, this was something we could do now, we usually don't, but we went and stripped out all of our Creole-speaking American police officers from New York, Miami, Boston, and LA. And we had this contingent of 70 of these guys that went out and worked with this new police force, and they were just phenomenal. They were patient and knew the cultural nuances, had the Creole, not just French, as most of the other police trainers had. And, you know, you realize America in many ways is just uniquely placed because of the nature of our multicultural society to do some of this stuff. So that's the things I think I would point to up front.
I think it's interesting that, you know, unfortunately, Haiti starts off as the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, and they're still there. And the situation is, of course, deteriorating, and I hope we'll get to that in a minute. But the people living there, it's hard to even imagine. I mean, can we talk a little bit about the actual conditions that people live under?
Yeah, it's pretty miserable. And it is, well, just one frame of reference. I mean, I just turned 65. I got a friend in Haiti. We work together really closely. He's, if not my age, a little younger, but not much. So he goes all the way back to Duvalier. And I just asked him, I said, you know, how do you measure the last, whatever, six decades of history? He said, this right now is the worst it's ever been. So frame of reference is pretty bad. And that's going through an awful lot. That's going through an earthquake and, you know, all these different periods of ups and downs. But he said it's just a daily struggle now because of the gangs and the way they've kind of locked down everything. So that's, you know, the short-term frame of reference. The rest of it all, it's a little bit like, and you don't want to just blame the international community for everything. And I think that's actually not a good move for Haitians, because whatever's happened has happened. A lot of times you talk to Haitians and you get a history lesson, and I say, I got the history. We got to move on. Let's see where we go from here. But it was, you know, it's a society that's, they're actually very skilled. In a lot of ways, they used to have a corner on the market of the baseball industry back in the 60s and 70s. They made all the world's baseballs. Incredibly talented artisans. And that sounds, you know, quaint, but there's actually a lot of that has been. That they had, you know, great factories for textiles, kind of a easy place to do textiles when things are stable. Again, a very hardworking, talented population. They flourish everywhere they go. So there's, you know, it's not the people, it's the system. And it is a system that internal to Haiti, not just because of us, has been very predatory. A great divide between the country and the city, which is another set of problems. But, you know, lots of potential. We didn't do many favors in a couple of places. We made them kill all their pigs at one point because we were afraid of some kind of swine flu or something. And then it never recovered. So you had this really kind of important part of their protein and their agriculture that never, ever recovered. There's a lot of, you know, bad policies that they came up with themselves, but we, again, didn't help. We kind of destroyed their rice industry at a certain point. And then we embargoed them. You got to really think about some of these embargoes. You know, we had a short-term political objective during the coup period. So in the early 90s, we're trying to get them back on track without intervention. At some point, you got to ask yourself, maybe an intervention would have been less costly to everybody. But we pretty much wiped out their industrial base in the 90s with the embargo. They never really recovered from that either. So it's not to blame everything on us. And they certainly could have done better recovering from some of this on their own. But we haven't done them any favors. So it's been a real grind agriculturally, industrially. It's just really, and they've never quite found their footing. I will say this, it's amazing to me that the tenacity.
Well, it sounds like we keep tripping them a little bit.
Yeah.
It's not just that they don't find their footing, it's that their biggest and most powerful neighbor keeps pushing them down.
Yeah. Yeah. That is fair. And then times we could have been helpful, not always the right thing. There was a big debate when I was there in the 90s, and it's a great debate, and I think it's one we need to have more frequently. It came up again when I was in Iraq, and we really railed over this, but there's a question about, in a country that's so battered and we're trying to get them back on their feet, do we run them through a neoliberal reform program, or do we just get people back to work, get to the neoliberal stuff later? But we've done this a few places, and I think Haiti, it was a huge mistake. There was a lot of people at the time that I wasn't in that field. I was doing security and justice. But I remember Robert Oakley, a pretty famous ambassador that was writing about this at the time. He said, you know, they need jobs right now, and we need to get to political stability first, and then you can do some of this other stuff. The model that came up later, and when I was in Iraq, it was really interesting because I remember Ambassador Bremer was arguing, no, we got to get the Iraqis to a proper neoliberal framework and cut all the state-owned enterprises and you know, get their economy righted. And then private sector will come in and run wild and everybody will have jobs. And man, all of us in the field, I was in Al-Anbar, and Petraeus is up in the north, Odierno's up in somewhere, Dempsey's there. We had the whole future leadership of the U.S. military there. And everybody just said, you got to be kidding. We need jobs. We have got young men running around with guns, and they will either shoot people or we'll put them to work. But so anyway, but we did that in Haiti. We just they crushed them through a neoliberal kind of program. And it was Aristide fought against it. He had a lot of bad decisions, a lot of bad inclinations. But I think that might have been one where he was absolutely right. So that period when we could have, in my opinion, favored jobs first, got people to work, even make work stuff infused into the economy, that probably would have bought the political stability to then get to some of the other stuff later. That was kind of the Hungarian program. And it was interesting in Iraq that somebody, I think it was Bremer himself, pointed to Hungary as the example. I said, I'm on loan from the embassy in Hungary. I'm living there now. And I can tell you that is not what they did. They're the darling of the transitional economies of Eastern Europe, but mainly because they took 4 years under their first post-communist government and they stabilized the political situation while they left the economy alone. And then they went through the Bogdanovich plan and did the reforms. So anyway, that's, I think we have, you know, we get in a hurry. We want to rush through it. We want the private sector in there. We don't want to spend all this money. You know, and then on the back end, we end up spending billions on security where we could have bought ourselves out of it at pretty low cost doing some smarter stuff.
I mean, and Haiti's almost a special case in that it's very small. I mean, you would think that how much money would it really have cost?
It's modest. You know, again, people, it's so funny to me because we throw these figures around. Well, we spent billions of dollars. You start adding it up, prorating it across the population, prorating it across whatever decades we're talking about. It's not that much money. It's pretty modest in the end. And again, if you start adding up the balance sheet of what we then spend on security missions that might not have been necessary. We've been in our own way a lot, and there's been some things that would have been probably easier to do a different way.
So what does the imposition of a top-down neoliberal order look like in Haiti? What are you doing instead of providing people jobs?
Well, you know, it's cutting all the state-owned industries trying to attract the private sector, but again, without always the incentives to do that. Fiscal monetary policies that would be hard on people, even on food security sometimes. The whole package that comes in with a strong IMF program.
So it's like the International Monetary Fund comes in, cuts a huge loan, and then country is slowly eaten alive by trying to pay back that loan over the next, you know, however many decades. That kind of classic.
Yeah, the loan would be actually the least of the problems. It would be all the conditions that the loan comes with. And, you know, reduce the size of government. It's reasonable stuff. So, you know, are you ready to throw people out of work from state-owned enterprises that are inefficient? Are you ready to throw people out of work from, you know, all these different, for example, the security forces? I mean, it's another place where it's really kind of acute. They demobilized the army. That's a whole other issue on security. Aristide was afraid of a coup, justifiably. He'd already had one, and he was afraid of another one. So he disbanded the army. Well, now you got all these guys running around without work that are also armed and everything else. There's not an easy answer to this because we're going to go through this again with the gangs because we're going to have to do another a demobilization program for these gangs. And it's a real kicker because the people are looking at this and saying, look, these are the guys that wrecked our country. And now they're getting better jobs than me. You got to be kidding. But absent that, they're going to continue to be predators on society. So it's a hard thing. Nobody has an easy answer to that. But in the short term, you know, throwing out all these guys out of work. So, you know, it's fiscal monetary policy that makes things harder, exchange rates and everything else. And then it's the, you know, again, kicking people out of work from state-owned enterprises, from security forces, from government. Those are the kind of things that I think leaving some of that alone for a bit, you know, on medical care and all the rest, you know. It's expensive to do that through the state, but if that's going to produce that short-term stability, you know, probably a longer transition is a better answer. Again, the security forces are where it's really acute.
Right, because as you said, you demobilize the security forces. What else are they going to do for work but kidnap, sell drugs, kill people, start to kind of flock to these larger personalities that are in the area? And that's kind of how you get the situation we're in now, which we haven't really, we're in now, I say, that Haiti's in now, which we haven't really talked about. Can you kind of tell us what's been going on the past few months?
Yeah, so you basically had in 2021, you had the assassination of Moise. Very complicated thing that we still don't know exactly what happened there. But he was, they had this long period of just really muddled politics. And he, you know, had refused to hold an election when he should have. Again, there was a lot of really nasty back channel stuff going on against him, with him. Gangs were starting to form up as muscle for the different political leaders. And that was another thing that just started to, they were not only criminal gangs out there waiting to kidnap people as it evolved into, but they were the muscle for the different political groups. So there was this real unholy alliance between gangs and political leaders. And that's also, again, been, it's a long-standing thing. Anyway, so he, Henri comes in. He'd just been in office as prime minister for a few weeks. It's a very muddled executive branch. The prime minister kind of runs the government. The president is the head of state. So it's one of those things. And I look at it that a lot of countries, when they came out of dictatorship or whatever, they sometimes will overcompensate. And, you know, you got these countries that have these desperately long constitutions because they want to cover every little contingency that might ever happen in the future, because we, you know, we came out of this really hard place in the past. And with Haiti, it was trying to balance power to where it wasn't centralized. But in the process, you've got a power structure that's really a bit muddled. So anyway, he takes over the whole government after Moise is assassinated. Very low popular support. And backing up from now, there hasn't been an election for Haiti. You know, they're working in a totally unconstitutional, non-constitutional, extra-constitutional framework right now, where he just kind of muddled through. And I met with him a few months ago, and I realized, you know, he's really got a lot of enemies. So part of it, I was a little bit more sympathetic at that period than many had been, looking at the situation he was in. But he really has a desperate kind of, had a desperate situation. It's even worse now because he can't even get back in the country. But it was a tough road he had to try to govern. But it really wasn't him. He's a neurosurgeon, not really, you know, executive branch material. He kind of fell into the job. So, and they just weren't sure what to do. So they go through this now almost 3 years where they had a number of different initiatives, the December 21 Accord that looked promising for a little while. They had another one in September before that. So September of 21, September of, of 21, there was all these different accords that they were trying to get make work. None of them quite came out. And so, these are in 2022. So anyway, going through all these different things, and different groups were trying to figure out how to get through this. The Montana group forms up, a group of political and civil society leaders that offered themselves as to be a government, and that was not accepted by the United States and others. The United States played a really interesting role. It was almost like we did just enough to preclude other solutions, but not enough to make the core solution work. Brzezinski talked about this once. He said, sometimes we get just enough involved that, you know, we're responsible for what happens, but we're not involved enough to make it work. And I think there was a little bit of that going on here. So the U.S. is kind of, we want a Haitian solution, but we don't want that Haitian solution. So we're going to be stuck with this one. So we're kind of going through this stuff, and nothing's working. And then eventually he was supposed to have held elections by February 7th of this year. It was this kind of seminal date. He kind of got through that, and there was no uprising or anything. So he goes off to CARICOM, where they were still trying to negotiate a new transitional government. And then he goes to Kenya, where they were offering to bring in a peacekeeping force under a UN mandate, but as a coalition. While he's out of the country, The gangs then finally rise up, take over the, start shooting up the airport, and he can't get back. So he's now stuck. So you had this grinding security crisis with the gangs taking over more and more of Port-au-Prince. And that was largely because a lot of their gravy train from different political leaders was ending. And so they just said, the way we can make money is kidnapping. But I've never seen anything quite like this where, you know, kidnapping literally shuts down almost an entire capital because you just can't move. Everybody is afraid of getting kidnapped. So very small routes and very small safe havens and stuff like that in the whole city. And then as on the security side and on the governance side, again, the government is just kind of inert. It just wasn't functioning, weak ministers, not a lot of energy, resources, anything else. So governance and security are both at this crisis point. It's not quite a failed state. I was discussing with this with someone last night, and I was arguing it's an extremely fragile state. There is still a threat of a government, still have a flag, they still have a currency. It's not Somalia, where I served when it was a true failed state. So it ain't quite there, but it's pretty close.
The leader can't get back into the country because gangs have control of the airport.
That's pretty close.
It's pretty close. But I will just say this. I mean, you know, Somalia, when the government totally collapsed, this is important to me. It took two full decades to get a government back. And it was actually a very interesting saga. I've also got a chapter in my book where I recount this. I mean, it was a long time to reestablish a no kidding government. There's still a threat of a government here. I would argue that, you know, there's going to be a big difference when the gangs have taken over the country than there is now. Because your option then is, it really is nothing but a full-on occupation, whatever you want to call it. I mean, now there's still some options now, but they're shrinking fast because there's less and less to work with. There's less and less, you know, terrain and everything else. So it's going to get harder. But I would argue that this last thread of governance is worth preserving and surging on now to get it, you know, reestablished. And there's no easy way to do that. It's going to be harder than what we want to do, obviously.
Do the gangs want to be in charge?
You know, we debate this a lot. I think there's some there's some, like Barbecue is the famous one. He's the most charismatic and he shows himself as this insurgent leader. I'm getting these messages on LinkedIn from people that seem semi-credible that are saying, you're too hard on these guys. They're insurgents. We need to treat them just the same way that we would have treated the FARC in Colombia or the FMLN in El Salvador. They need to be part of a governing arrangement. It's very strange to me. We at USIP are very strong about this. No gangs in government. This would be, to us, just madness to allow a share of governance for people that have no ideology. They are just gangs that are muscle for different people. There's nothing there to work with. And the people really despise them. I mean, any, you know, because there's talk now of an arrangement where they would maybe be a part of a, they got very close actually in this last accord that's being negotiated now. They got danger close to having somebody that would almost represent them. So that I think, you know, we always feared that there would be a coalition of gangs that would finally be strong enough to march on the palace. That hasn't happened up until now. The last kind of big surge was this guy, Guy Philippe, which astoundingly was in American jail up until 6 months ago. And we released him for reasons I really don't understand. So he comes back and, you know, he was an insurgent leader in 2004. So he's been an insurgent leader for a long time. And then he was in jail in the United States for 5 or 6 years for running drugs. It was a very odd case. We had him. And then we, for some reason, again, let him go. So he comes back to Haiti and he immediately links up with the equivalent of their forest service, the BPAP. And these guys are guys that run around in trucks protecting, you know, forests and plants and stuff like that. And he gets them as his gang somehow. So they're his force. But he kind of overplayed his hand. He tried to come into Port-au-Prince and make a big show, got very little support. Barbecue also has had limited support broadly. I mean, he's brutally controls a piece of territory, does all these, you know, walkabouts in the neighborhood talking about what a great insurgent leader he is, but it doesn't add up to much. I think they're bumping up against each other a lot. They know there's natural limitations from the people. The people have fought back. They had this movement, Bois Calais, where they were, and Haitians are kind of natural vigilantes. I actually saw some of it when I was there. You'd see somebody tied up in somebody's front yard and a bunch of people around them, ready to beat him to death until the police came. So it's a very natural kind of vigilante society, I hate to say it. And that's another break on some of what these guys do. So I think unless they could unite fully, I don't think they would have the capacity to take over the government. But it's one of those things, kind of like nuclear terrorism. If you wake up tomorrow and it happens, you know, it happens. And, you know, we don't see it happening, but who knows what's going on under the surface. So I don't think they're trying to take over the government. I think they just want to keep running their enterprises. They're going to have to be negotiated with separately in terms of demobilization and whatever happens to them. But I hope that in the process of forming what is, you know, desperately going on now to form a new government, that they're not part of it.
It does seem like natural vigilantes. Maybe that's the only form of justice that's available to people.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of it is just self-protection. So I don't know how far that's going to go. It is something to think about because, you know, we're going to have a very minimalist international presence doing very minimal stuff. So there are, you know, there's ways that citizens could be mobilized short of, you know, necklacing and all this sort of thing, but they could easily be mobilized to help take care of their own security. Again, there's lots to work with in Haiti. I always remind people it's not just an inert society waiting for somebody to come in and do everything for them, but it just needs the resources, organization, leadership. And so, yeah, I think that's a real plus that could be, again, could be mobilized community by community. They're actually very tight communities in their own way. They have their own rhythm and style. And, you know, you get in the villages and the neighborhoods in Port-au-Prince. And yeah, it's there's a lot there that could be spun up.
What does the Dominican Republic think of all this?
Well, that's a very tense relationship they've had for quite a while. It's an interesting relationship because the Dominicans really rely on Haitian labor. They have all this low-cost Haitian labor. You know, they're a mid-range economy now. They're doing okay. They have a ton of tourism and a pretty good industrial base. So the Dominican Republic does reasonably well. It kind of relies on the Haitians, but doesn't want to be overwhelmed by them. But a very, very fraught relationship going way back. So it's a very tense, you know, tense relationship. And it goes all the way back into the 19th century with some military stuff back and forth. And so they're not the partner one would hope for that could be helpful. They could be helpful just in how they manage the border, how they manage trade going across the border. So they've got a real key role to play, but not political, not in terms of security and helping the security forces. So not the big things that are in play now, but they do have a key role in terms of how they manage their relationship. Because again, that land border is really kind of critical. There's a ton of stuff that goes across it. And then managing their share of the migration issue, you know, and regularizing Haitians to the extent they can. They've done a lot of that and, you know, try to make sure that the labor that is in the Dominican Republic is fairly treated. But there's all these nationalistic issues as well. They had the flare up about the river and the canal and the border itself. So there's some real issues there. It plays also to close on that, it's a political issue inside the Dominican Republic. You know, there's like anti-immigrant movements and stuff like that. So they have to kind of play to their own constituency as well.
This is just, I don't know. It's such an interesting perspective and just to understand these. I guess we should say just on the Dominican Republic, they are very different. I mean, they were settled differently by different or colonized by different countries. And language is not in common. They just happen to share an island.
Yeah, they got a very different start. I mean, they got the same start basically as, I think you could just say Central America, you know, a minor colony of the Spanish that got its independence. And again, lots of ups and downs and eventually their own U.S. occupation in the 60s. But, you know, they've done relatively well. They've done Honduran, Salvadoran standards of things, maybe even a little bit better. They have a decent formula for governance, but also they struggle quite a bit. But I, you know, you put them in the same cast of most of Spanish speaking Latin America, close to the English-speaking Caribbean as well. Again, Haiti, without the language, without a natural association with everybody else in the region, that isolation, I just can't stress enough, has really been chilling to them their whole history.
Matthew, did you have anything else?
My only stray thought on this is charting the progression of the gangs through the rap videos of Yuzu 5 Segond. I think I'm saying that correctly, maybe. And watching the aesthetic turn from, I think, what most people would think of as like Haitian rap music, like you hear that and what his videos look like, you've probably got it. Whatever you're picturing in your mind, you've probably got it. But then a month or so ago, around when the violence really starts, I would say that he adopts tactical global war on terror aesthetic and is now projecting in his videos as if he's running some sort of special operations force. And that is different and kind of goes to what you were saying about the gangs kind of taking a different tact in a different mood and maybe turning into something else, or at least projecting that they're trying to turn into something else, right? That's not really a question. It's just
but it's important. I mean, and actually let me go a little bit forward too, because I think we need to look at what's the way out of this, you know. But yeah, those videos are actually interesting, and I've seen some, you know, tactical analysis of them. They're showing that there is a sophistication, a military tactical sophistication in the gangs that has been missing before. We're not exactly sure where that came from, but there is some clear infusion of U.S. tactics, techniques, training that is in some of these guys. Now, what that means is you've got a much more capable force that whoever comes in is going to be dealing with. And this is really kind of critical. The Kenyan force that's shaping up, there's a UN mandate that authorized the Coalition of the Willing. The U.S. not being willing, task that off to the Kenyans. They are trying to round up the posse. It's not clear this is going to work. And I think it's getting, you know, realistically, one of two things could happen. They could come in and just get bottled up in the airport and not really be able to be effective, or they just don't have the numbers and the capacity to do what needs to be done. Then the worst case is they come in and actually get in some engagements, they actually get beat and then chased out. And so there's a kind of a mega Black Hawk Down scenario that's looming if it's not taken more seriously and done better. I mean, we've thrown out some ideas. You could contract a lot of this out, get a more effective force to bolster the Kenyans. There would have to be a massive train and equip mission for the police that's being piecemealed. The Haitian army is kind of on the books. It was eliminated and then restored at a very small number, but that's where there's still a lot of capacity that could be built. Anyway, there's just a mishmash of forces that I think is worse than it's been before. Now, there's different views of that. Some say, no, the gangs, as soon as anybody shows up, they'll all go to ground. May have been true 6 months ago. I'm not sure it is now. So again, there's capacity there that's kind of disturbing. So there's a lot on the side of the MSS, they call it, the multinational security support mission, that it's just not shaping up. It's not quite there. And then on the political side, there's a new governing council that's shaping up, a transitional council. That's a technique that's been used before. It was kind of what they did in 2004 to restore the government. They had a council of sages, kind of seven prominent Haitians that got together, and then they selected the leader, and then that was their interim leader until they had an election. And that's really all we're trying to do now is get to an election, but that's still 12 to 18 months off. So there's this interim period where security's got to be established, politics has got to be, governance has got to be restored. And it's really a trick. We used to do the chicken and egg thing, which comes first, governance or security? Govern first and then security. But now it's absolutely security. They can't do anything until that's restored. And there's not, again, a real formula quite for doing that. It is amazing that the HNP is still fighting back. There's still a lot of these guys that have tenaciously held on, and that last wave of assaults 2 weekends ago, they held their ground in a lot of places, and that was, I think, a check on the gang. So everything's still kind of in play. There's a lot to work with. It could happen, but there's going to probably have to be a much bigger everything: political effort, governance effort, and then the economic support and the humanitarian support behind that. It's classic UN. This is what the UN does. They're not available for this one for a number of reasons. So recreating all that outside the UN system, it's a lot. So anyway, hopefully there's, again, some way through some creative mechanism. But we've become really obsessed with what we keep calling the Haitian-led solution. And we just don't want to get too involved. And then kind of the aversion to the hard work of nation building to begin with is just not where we are. So, you know, it's a limiting thing. But, yeah, it's, you know, there, this could go on still for quite a while, and it could get a lot worse. So, you know, while there's still something to work with, I would think this would be the time to really get all the pieces in place and do what would be needed.
Well, as long as we don't get Paul Bremer back, maybe we've got a chance. Anyway, thank you so much.
Yeah, great to be with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Changer plan. Si moun pas entrer dans gendarme, m'te gué t'en changer d'an. Parce que Matisse m'a frappé l'IA, nous en voulons manger m'nan. Nous t'y conseil d'ami m'a pas parlé fort.
M'a tout la même n'en dan.
Mettez pour à terre, tu voulais attaquer m'tout bon vrai. Tentez la bloc ou c'est roi ou c'est bon. Mettez pour à terre, n'est-ce pas gué clan vrai. Soda la bolotio, n'est-ce pas gué clan vrai. Mettez pour à terre, tu voulais attaquer m'tout bon vrai. Tentez la bloc ou c'est roi ou c'est bon. Mettez pour à terre, n'est-ce pas gué clan vrai.
Passé l'en tête, il fait 12 dégâts. L'en face carré, l'en matissant, il était pour plomb 12 déjà. Si vous n'êtes pas bon, faut aller en village, nous vit déjà. M'connais dans vie crasé, bas sa peau, j'abé sin dégâts. Pour m'te pour M4, des balles n'est pas seul l'en coup. Même vie, m'barre la chaud, à pas à cacher l'en tout. M'bran la ria, ma vine droite, à pas n'a pas seul l'en coup. Même dans ce truc là, guitare, m'chaîne balle, m'est passé l'en coup. M'bap fait pléonas, nous connais m'son village dédié. En même temps, j'ai sa te la donne, son village blanchi. Blanc comme t'es pour ambassade. La dog a plein refus. Vin démenti dans villageois. Nous mettons ça comme des fous. Nous pas voyer goûter. Essayer à faute une balle ou à pégouter. Nous pas baiser back up, négo. Les n'a pas braillé. C'est nous qui hat. Bat quoi, c'est nous qui lâche. C'est que c'est good game, c'est que zombie, c'est nous qui pêche. Mettez pour à terre. Tu voulais attaquer tout ton vrai. Tentez la bloc ou c'est roi ou c'est bon. Mettez pour à terre. N'est-ce pas gué clan vrai. Soda la bolotio. N'est-ce pas gué clan vrai. Mettez pour à terre. Tu voulais attaquer tout ton vrai.
Six seconds.